Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your genial host, Alex P. Linder, and whatever I do is recorded for all posterity, for all time, at vnnforum.com, and that includes chapters of the book of The Murder of Little Mary Fagan by Mary Fagan, her great niece. We've done 8 chapters, now let's get into chapter 9, which is a short chapter, and then we'll also do chapter 10, a longer one, with the based on Alonzo Mann and his evidence. But chapter 9, we've just had Leo Frank trial. It went this way. We had the prosecutor, we had the defense, we had the conviction, we had the sentence to death, we had the commutation, and then last chapter, chapter 8, we had the lynching, and now chapter 9, reverberations. Mary Fagan says, "The Knights of Mary Fagan stood guard for at least one day and one night at the tree from which they had hung Leo Frank, apparently expecting that someone, perhaps souvenir hunters, or someone on the orders of Governor Harris, who had offered a reward for the conviction of any of the lynch party, might cut it down. 2 months after the lynching, the group climbed to the top of Stone Mountain outside of Atlanta and burned a large cross. They say it was visible all over Atlanta. On October 26, 1915, William J. Simmons, an ex-Methodist minister and a member of at least 8 fraternal orders, gathered together 34 men, including members of the Knights of Mary Fagan and 3 former Ku Klux Klan members, and signed an application to the state of Georgia to charter the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. On November 25th, Thanksgiving Day, Simmons again convened this group, and they ascended Stone Mountain and formally inaugurated the new invisible empire of the Ku Klux Klan." Again, late 1915, on Thanksgiving Day 1915, they re-inaugurated it. This is the effect that this case and its resolution with the justice hanging of Leo Frank had, not just in Georgia, but across the country. They again burned a large cross. The original Ku Klux Klan, founded in Nashville, Tennessee in 1867, was a secret society opposed to the Reconstruction policies of the Radical Republican Congress, and whose purpose was the reestablishment of white supremacy in the South. General N.B. Forrest, well-known Confederate cavalry leader, was the first Grand Wizard of the Empire. The Empire immediately began a campaign of terror against ex-slaves and whites who involved themselves in black causes. They operated at night, their identities obliterated under white sheets. Their methods were flogging, torture, and lynching. They usually planted a burning cross on the property of someone whom they felt they had to threaten. It was their calling card. It has been said that the Mary Fagan Leo Frank case was the spark that rekindled the Ku Klux Klan. As whites regained control of state governments in the South, the Klan's power faded. In 1869, General Forrest ordered the abandonment of the Klan and resigned as Grand Wizard, but local organizations continued, some for many years. The release in 1915 of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation further fueled the fires of the new invisible empire, which added to its motto of white supremacy, anti-Catholicism, and anti-Semitism. Its appeal, therefore, was wider than that of the original Klan. So the original Klan was a southern thing, but then you have these waves of immigration from southern and eastern Europe of Jews and Catholics. A lot of them were non-traditional Protestant Christians, and so the Klan could resurge in the north among northern WASP or German types who didn't like the social demographic changes that were occurring in the country, and which resulted in the 1924 Immigration Act limiting incoming stocks to their percentage of the existing stocks of the population. A law which Jews denounced as nativism and sought for decades to overturn, succeeding in 1965, 4 decades later. So, in 1915, not only is Leo Frank hanged, but D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation comes out, and that, as I said, further fueled the fires of the new invisible empire, which added to its motto of white supremacy, anti-Catholicism, and anti-Semitism. Its appeal, therefore, was wider than that of the original Klan. In the early 1920s, with the help of experienced promoters and fundraisers Edward Y. Clark and Elizabeth Tyler, the Klan began exercising strong control over local politics throughout the South and spread rapidly into the North, especially Oregon, Oklahoma, Indiana, Maine, and Illinois. In 1922, 1924, and 1926, it elected many state officials and a number of congressmen. At one point, the Invisible Empire claimed 1 million members, and this is exactly what whites need. No matter what it's called, they need a group that protects them and looks out for their own interests. For 10 years after its inauguration or re-inauguration, the Klan exercised a career of terror. Then the death of another girl destroyed its power. In 1926, David C. Stevenson, who had ousted William Simmons from the leadership of the Klan and was at that time Imperial Wizard, was convicted of second-degree murder in the death of Madge Oberholzer, whom, in consort with other Klansmen, he had kidnapped, raped, and abducted to Chicago from Irvington, Indiana. The case, which included some revolting perversions, created a widespread revulsion against the Ku Klux Klan. Throughout the 1930s, its influence weakened irreparably. In 1944, it was formally dissolved. 5 years later, however, groups from 6 southern states met again to reform a national organization. During the Civil Rights era, the Klan again raised its head. It has never really died. It is recruiting members today. It recently attempted to involve my family. And of course, the FBI was attacking it from that point forward. In the months following the lynching, about 3,000 Jews left the state of Georgia. And others have said, who knows if that's actually true. Those who remained, and particularly those in Atlanta, were financially crippled by a huge boycott of Jewish businesses. So again, whites protecting themselves from predatory Jews is a good thing. The Jewish community, or at least some of its more prominent members, had felt, in fact, an increasing anti-Semitism for the previous 3 decades or so. This feeling mounted as resentment of the monies which poured in from Jewish organizations around the country, particularly in the North, to aid Leo Frank's defense and subsequent appeals soared. If Mary Fagan's death and Leo Frank's lynching gave impetus to the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, they also gave impetus to the formation of the Anti-Defamation League, a B'nai B'rith. At the time of his arrest, Leo Frank was the president of the Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith, the Jewish fraternal order which had been founded in 1843. There were plans for the organization of its Anti-Defamation League to combat anti-Semitism in the United States and to work for equality of opportunity for all Americans in our time, as their charter reads, but it took the condemnation of Leo Frank to galvanize it into being. The League was established 4 weeks after Leo Frank's trial ended. As Dave Sherry, S-C-H-A-R-Y, the fourth national chairman of the League, has stated, quote, "Certainly the B'nai B'rith would have founded the League sooner or later, but the story of Leo Frank struck the American Jewish community like nothing before in its experience. It was Frank's destiny to give the League a sense of urgency that characterizes its operations to this day. We must protect the Jewish pedophile. We must protect the Jewish torturer. We must protect the Jewish murderer. The Goyim are starting to think they have a right to their own lives rather than simply serving as stock animals for us and whores for us." At the founding ceremonies of the League, Adolf Kraus, K-R-A-U-S, then national president of B'nai B'rith, commenting on the widespread prejudice and discrimination, said, "Remarkable as it is, this condition has gone so far as to manifest itself recently in an attempt to influence courts of law where a Jew happened to be a party to the litigation. This symptom, standing by itself, while contemptible, would not constitute a menace, but forming as it does but one incident in a continuing chain of occasions of discrimination, it demands organized and systematic effort on behalf of all right-thinking Americans to put a stop to this most pernicious and un-American tendency." There, the Jew is brazenly flipping the truth and pretending to speak for America, which is a very typical sort of a double lie. The Anti-Defamation League, practically from its inception, vigorously opposed all lynchings. It, along with the NAACP, works to correct falsehoods in all forms of media and to... that's laughably untrue. That is the exact opposite of the truth. And Fagan is simply taking what the ADL puts forward to the public in its official press announcements for the reality. The reality is the ADL does nothing but spy and lie and work to create white genocide by promoting mongrelization and laws that result in blacks attacking white. The ADL and the Jews facilitate genocidal attacks on white nations across the globe, knowingly and intentionally striving to bring about conditions that will conduce to white genocide is what the ADL does. She says the ADL owes its genesis to Leo Frank and to Mary Fagan. It, along with NAACP, works to correct falsehoods in all forms of media and to distribute information correcting misconceptions about Judaism? No, it works to spread misconceptions. It works to veil. That's why it puts forward under a neutral name. We're against defamation. They just want neutral respect for everybody. But no, what they in fact want is the Jewish agenda put forward unquestioningly. Yeah, of course they're against a Jew receiving justice, and she better than anyone ought to understand that. After, if they had their way, Leo Frank wouldn't have even been charged with a crime if he were guilty, because the idea that a Jew can commit a crime against a goyim is not a Jewish idea. It's the Jewish idea is that goyim exist to be used. They are animals who exist to be used by Jews, and they have no rights. That's what Jews actually believe. What they put out to the public is a cover story. But if you watch their behavior, you see the truth. They don't care if one of their own is a rapist and a murderer. They will defend him. Why? Because he's one of their own. What they won't tell people like Mary Fagan is he has the right to do that by Jewish doctrines. That's in their Talmud and their Torah, that he has the right to rape and murder that white girl if he so desires. After Leo Frank's death, Lucille Frank became a pillar of the Atlanta Jewish community. She worked in one of the better women's clothing shops, never remarried, and until she died in 1957, signed all her checks and papers Mrs. Leo M. Frank. In March 1916, Fannie Fagan Coleman sued the National Pencil Company for damages. It was settled out of court, and she was awarded several thousand dollars. She died in August 1947 at age 75. She was buried beside Mary. Tom Watson was indicted and tried in the United States District Court for sending obscene matter through the mail and was acquitted in 1916. Initially, he supported Hugh Dorsey in the gubernatorial race. Dorsey won and remained governor of Georgia until 1921. In 1920, Dorsey ran for the United States Senate, but Watson himself ran and won. 2 years later, he died from a bronchial attack. One of the memorials on his grave was a cross, 8 feet high and made of roses. The Ku Klux Klan had sent it. Jim Connolly served less than a year of his sentence on a chain gang. Some months after that, he was convicted of breaking and entering a business establishment in the vicinity of the Fulton County Courthouse and was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment, which he served. It was after that that he and my grandfather and my aunt had the famous, in our family, conversation about little Mary Fagan. Then he apparently disappeared, and that was recorded in an earlier chapter. In 1941, he was among a group picked up for gambling by the Atlanta police. In 1947, he was arrested on a charge of drunkenness. He died in 1962. Rumors of a deathbed confession of his having killed Mary Fagan have grown increasingly more persistent. On April 6, 1987, my father and I spoke with three members of the ADL, Stuart Lewengrub, L-E-W-E-N-G-R-U-B, Regional Director of the Southeast Office, Betty Cantor, Assistant Regional Director of the Southeast Office, and Charles Wittenstein, Counsel for the Southeast Office. The League, we felt, would certainly have tracked down and confirmed this rumor. All three were emphatic. The rumor had no basis in truth. Publications, films, and plays concerning the Mary Fagan-Leo Frank case began even before Leo Frank was lynched. 1914. This will be a list of 10, 12, dozen or so publications and plays. 1914, the Frank case. Inside story of George's murder, published by Atlanta Publishing Company. Argument of Hugh Dorsey, solicitor for Fulton County, published. C.P. Connolly reported the trial in Collier's Weekly and then published a book, The Truth About the Frank Case, and he was pretty much a shill for the Jews, I recall from elsewhere. The French journalist, this is another liar, Van Paassen, P-A-A-S-S-E-N, claims that the teeth marks on Mary Fagan's head and shoulders do not match the x-rays of Leo Frank's teeth. He publishes his findings in the book To Number Our Days in 1964. 1936, so that's 1914, 1915, they published Dorsey, 15 is Connolly, 22, Van Paassen, 36, Death in the Deep South by Ward Green is published. 1937, They Won't Forget, a movie based on Ward Green's novel starring Lana Turner as Little Mary Clay, appears. 1938, Tom Watson, Agrarian Rebel by C. Van Woodward is published. 1943, I Can Go Home Again by Arthur Powell published. 1952, Guilty or Not Guilty by Francis X. Bush published, or by Francis X. Bush is published. 1956, Night Fell on Georgia by Charles and Louise Samuels is published. 1959, Confessions of a Criminal Lawyer by Ellen Lumpkin Henson, published. 1962, Profile in Courage series is aired by NBC. One deals with John M. Slayton. 1965, that would be overt Jewish propaganda. 1965, A Little Girl is Dead by Harry Golden, published. Presumably more Jewish lies. 1967, a five-part series on the trial appears in the Atlanta Constitution, and the play Night Witch has a short run. 1968, The Leo Frank Case by Leonard Dinnerstein is published, reissued in 1987, and that is chock full of lies. There have been innumerable murders in Georgia since April 26, 1913, when Little Mary Fagan was murdered. None have continued to fascinate the public as my great aunt's tragedy has. Students, writers, and the curious continue yearly to visit the Georgia Department of Archives, Georgia State University, and Emory University to study the case, and many people still pay tribute to Little Mary Fagan by visiting her grave. It is the history of Georgia. It is my history. That ends that brief chapter. The observation there would be that she just takes these things as continuing interest, but she doesn't understand the true context in which she's operating, the way that Jews are going to try to turn this into one of the couple hundred events that they make into little, basically historical memes for indoctrinating the goy population they're trying to control. So they'll portray the goy who sides, who sells out to the Jews, the goy traitor, Slayton, they'll portray him as a profile in courage. It's courageous to serve the Jews and to turn against your own people. The actual courageous people were those who lynched Frank and who refused to allow the Jews to pervert justice and buy it with their money. You see, so flipping things on their head is what Jews do, and I don't think that Fagan understands any of this. Now let's move along to Chapter 10, Alonzo Mann's Testimony. At the end of February 1978, my co-workers at Griffin CESA jokingly told me that I was on the front page. Silence fell over the room. The look in my face must have told them something. It couldn't be. Why was it on the front page now? It seemed I could never escape. I picked up the newspaper. It was the Atlanta Constitution. The banner headline read, The Murder of Mary Fagan, by Celestine Sibley, S-I-B-L-E-Y. A preface before the story indicated that they were doing a series on famous murders in Georgia. My father and I found several inaccuracies in the articles on Mary Fagan and felt we had to voice our opinion to the author. My father called Celestine Sibley, but the call was never returned. He was surprised. Several other Fagans were quite upset by the articles. John Fagan Durham, son of Lizzie Mary Etta Fagin, who made Little Mary's dress, and first cousin of Little Mary Fagin, went to Mr. Sears, the managing editor of the Atlanta Constitution, and asked that the articles be stopped. He said that Mr. Sears replied, "We cannot stop the articles, and if we have caused hard feelings with the Fagin family, we apologize, and if you would correct the factual inaccuracies, we would correct them." Durham informed Mr. Sears that he, Fagin Durham, would not make the corrections because the series appeared in the front page, and he was certain the corrections would not appear in the front page. People would not see them. He left, frustrated. The series rekindled interest concerning the murder of Little Mary Fagin and its aftermath. Principals, teachers, students, optometrists, and ophthalmologists in the 8 counties my work covered asked me that question. "Are you by any chance related to Little Mary Fagin?" The questions became more intense. People wanted details on the trial and the lynching and wanted to know if any of the Fagins were involved with the lynching. I wanted the truth to be known. I wanted the inaccuracies corrected. I became more articulate in discussing the case, and I felt a sense of confidence since I knew the story well and could answer most of the questions. I had plans to marry in June of that year. Bernard knew nothing of the story of Little Mary Fagin. I had never told him. He, like most, had read the series in the newspapers, and one night he mentioned that a girl was murdered who had my name. Then he, too, wanted to know, "Are you by any chance related to her?" "Yes," I said, "I am." "Why?" he wanted to know, and I never told him. "You never asked," I said. And then I told him. I told him the story and why the Fagin family had remained silent. But, I told him, we had something to say now, and my father agreed and was beginning to let it be known that there were close relatives of Little Mary Fagin who were still living. Daddy hadn't gone so far as to publicly acknowledge our existence, but had let certain individuals know in nonchalant ways. Bernard asked if I had ever been to the grave. I hadn't. I was bothered that my name was on a tombstone. Right then, we determined to go. We drove to Marietta. I was extremely quiet, and Bernard responded with silence. It was time. I felt the desire to go to the grave. It was a beautiful day, sunny with a light breeze. As we neared the cemetery, I began to feel sick to my stomach. Now I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to see the grave. "We're here," Bernard said suddenly. I hesitated. "Are you all right?" he asked. Somehow I felt inner strength. I'm ready," I told him softly. The plot was located in the wealthy section of the cemetery. There, beside Little Mary, were other Fagin family members, including William Jackson Fagin and Angelina O'Shields Fagin. Little Mary Fagin's grave was like none other that I had seen before. It had a marble tombstone which bore her name and an inscription the length of the burial place in marble. It was a beautiful inscription, and it was written by Tom Watson. I immediately memorized it. Bernard and I took photos for the scrapbook about Mary I had begun assembling. A middle-aged couple approached us and asked us if we knew where the grave of Little Mary Fagin was. The articles in the newspapers had once again revived interest in her. A sense of sadness for my relatives, especially those who had lived through the horrible ordeal, overcame me, and I admired them for not seeking publicity and wishing to remain anonymous. That year, 1978, proved to be full of beginnings and firsts for me. It was the first time my father had acknowledged our relationship to Mary by contacting a reporter. The beginning of a scrapbook of Little Mary, my first visit to the grave of Little Mary Fagin, and my first car accident, which turned out to have a connection to Mary Fagin. A few days after the accident, I decided to check on the elderly lady who had struck my car and to find out if she had turned in the insurance papers. She was a wealthy, prominent member of the community in which she lived. Her house was extraordinarily beautiful. When she answered the door, I explained that I was the individual involved in her accident, and I was checking to see if she had turned in the insurance papers. She welcomed me inside her home and told me that she was becoming blind and deaf and did not have anyone to help her fill out the form. She asked me if I would help. I filled out the paperwork and, with a magnifying glass, she read it to correct the errors. When she came to my name, she abruptly turned to me and asked me that question, "Are you by any chance related to Little Mary Fagin?" When I said yes, she hugged and kissed me. Then she related her memories of it. She and her husband drove their horse and buggy to Atlanta and saw the crowd of people waiting to hear the trial. Apparently, it had been an overwhelming sight. The majority of people at that time felt that Leo Frank was guilty, she said, and she believed it too. She still believed it. She excitedly told me about life in that era and how many changes she had seen in her 92 years. She liked some of the changes, but others she disliked. I had a wonderful time, and she invited me to have lunch with her. She had found that I listened to her attentively, and nowadays it seemed that no one really listened anymore. The next day I received another invitation for lunch. For the rest of the school year, I would lunch with her on Mondays. We became very close. In 1980, Bernard and I moved to Cobb County, where my family had begun. Since the travel was too far and too much for me, I resigned my position at Griffin, CESA, and began employment for the Cherokee County Board of Education in Canton, Georgia, as the itinerant teacher for the blind and visually impaired. When school began in August, my supervisor introduced me to the principals for whom I would be working. Several of them asked me that recurrent question, "Are you, by chance, related to Little Mary Fagan?" At one of the schools, the principal was not available to meet me, but as we were leaving, he ran out after us and asked me my name and what position I held for the county. He took out his pen from his shirt pocket, and as I told him my name, he wrote it on the palm of his hand. He stared at it and asked me that question. I told him, "Yes." He erased my name from his hand and told me he would never forget my name. From that moment on, Mr. Tippins called me Little Mary Fagan and introduced me as such. I didn't mind. Subtitle, Alonzo Mann. M-A-N-N. On Saturday, March 6, 1982, Sue Youngblood, one of the secretaries where I worked, called. She was very upset. She had been watching television and heard a promotional late news headline, something to the effect of, "An eyewitness says Leo Frank was not guilty of the murder of Little Mary Fagan. More details on the 11 o'clock news." Stunned and bewildered, I waited for the hours to pass. How could there be a witness alive? The local news provided a report from two reporters, Colin Sedor, S-E-D-O-R, from Georgia, and Jerry Thompson from Tennessee. They discussed the era of the crime and the basic facts of the case. Then they showed an interview with Alonzo Mann, a man who had said he had seen Jim Conley with the body of Mary Fagan. Mann, now 83 years of age and living in Virginia, appeared calm and competent as he spoke of these events. Alonzo Mann claimed he had attempted to relate what he had seen for years and that no one seemed interested. After a while, he told reporters, he had given up. He told reporters of the Tennessean that as a soldier during World War I, he'd engendered a heated argument with another soldier who happened to be from Georgia when he said that he knew that Leo Frank did not kill Mary Fagan. Over the years, he told his wife, his relatives, and his closest friends his story. During the 1950s, he told it to a reporter of an Atlanta newspaper. But Mann stated, the reporter said he didn't want to stir up the anti-Semitism that had engulfed Atlanta during the trial, and at the time of the commutation. "Mrs. Frank is still alive," the reporter had also said, "and we wouldn't want to do anything to cause her more any more grief." At about the time he gave his testimony to the media, Mann agreed to a polygraph test and a psychological stress analysis. The psychological stress analysis electronically measures on charts, with a needle and graph, the stress in the voice in response to questions. The greater stress there seems to be, the greater probability the subject is not telling the truth. The polygraph, broadly used by law enforcement personnel across the U.S., United States, tests whether the subject is telling the truth by measuring the respiratory rate, blood pressure, skin reaction, and pulse rate. In both procedures, the subject responds to questions and a pattern is printed out on a graph paper, connected to the machines which are connected to the subject's body. Alonzo Mann, according to both tests, told the truth consistently. Alonzo Mann's story was a new twist on the facts presented since 1913. He said that Jim Conley had said to him, "If you ever tell anyone, I'll kill you." He had gone home and repeated what he had seen and what he'd been told by Conley to his mother. She told him to be quiet, and he had been. Now, after almost 70 years of silence, he decided to come forward to be at peace in his heart. I wasn't the only one who was stunned, and I could not believe that Alonzo Mann would wait 70 years to reveal his eyewitness testimony. My father and I discussed at length the plausibility of Alonzo Mann's statements. We decided to remain silent until the sensationalism of the story quieted down. It didn't. On March 7, 1982, the Nashville Tennessean ran a special supplement which bore the headline, "An Innocent Man Was Lynched." The copy began, "Leo Frank, convicted in 1913 and lynched in 1915 in one of the most notorious cases in American history, was innocent according to sworn testimony by a witness in the case." The section contained quotations of the letters Leo Frank wrote to his family from prison, Alonzo Mann's statement, and the printout of the polygraph test he had taken. It contained photos of him at Mary Fagan's grave. The supplement was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Between the publication of that special supplement and Alonzo Mann's appearance before the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, reporters on the staff of the Tennessean initiated plans for a book and had even spoken to the producer of the television miniseries Winds of War. Pardon Board Chairman Mobley Howell was quoted as saying that the entire affair had taken on a showman quality. Also, on March 7, 1982, Cassandra Clayton, another local reporter, reported an interview with Bernie Dukehart, D-U-K-E-H-A-R-T, brother of one of the members of the lynching mob, in which Dukehart said that Alonzo Mann's statements changed nothing and that his brother always felt that Leo Frank was guilty. On the same newscast, there was an interview with Jasper Yeomans, son of Leo Frank's defense attorney. The reporter also spoke briefly with Stuart Lewingrub of the Anti-Defamation League, who expressed the desire that a posthumous pardon be granted. It was also reported that the Fagan family members denied the station's request for an interview and were tired of their name being dragged through the mud. The Fagan family member who denied the interview was John Fagan Durham. Ironically, at one point at this point, no one in the media knew that either my father or I existed, and several older Fagans who had lived through the murder and its aftermath had also kept silent, even though the media contacted them. They did not discuss the case with even their closest friends. On March 8, 1982, a review of the story appeared with the conclusion that a posthumous pardon for Leo Frank was unlikely. Alonzo's testimony read, "In the state of Tennessee, County of Sullivan, the undersigned being duly sworn deposes as follows. My name is Alonzo McClendon Mann. I am 83 years old. My father was Alonzo Mann, who was born in Germany. My mother was Hattie McClendon Mann. When I was a small boy, my family moved to Atlanta, where I spent most of my life. In 1913, I was the office boy for Leo Frank, who ran the National Pencil Company. That was the year Leo Frank was convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan. I was 14 years old at the time. I was called as a witness in the murder trial. At that time, I was put on the witness stand, but I did not tell all that I knew. I was not asked questions about what I knew. I did not volunteer. If I had revealed all I knew, it would have cleared Leo Frank and would have saved his life. I now suffer from a heart condition. I have undergone surgery to implant a pacemaker in my heart. I am making this statement because, finally, I want to have the record clear. I want the public to understand that Leo Frank did not kill Mary Fagan." Jim Conley, the chief witness against Leo Frank, lied under oath. "I know that. I am certain that he lied. I am convinced that he, not Leo Frank, killed Mary Fagan. I know as a matter of certainty that Jim Conley, and he alone, disposed of her body. Jim Conley threatened to kill me if I told what I knew. I was young and I was frightened. I had no doubt Conley would have tried to kill me if I had told that I had seen him with Mary Fagan that day. I related to my mother what I had seen there at the pencil factory. She insisted that I not get involved. She told me to remain silent. My mother loved me. She knew that Conley had threatened to kill me. She didn't want our family's name to be involved in controversy or for me to have to be subjected to any publicity. My father supported her in telling me to remain silent. My mother repeated to me over and over not to tell. She never thought Leo Frank would be convicted. Of course, she was wrong. Even after he was convicted, my mother told me to keep secret what I had seen. I am sure in my own mind that if the lawyers had asked me specific questions about what I had seen on the day of Mary Fagan's death, I would have told the whole truth when I testified at the Franks trial. Of course, they didn't suspect what I knew. They asked me practically nothing. I was nervous and afraid that day. There were crowds in the street who were angry and who were saying that Leo Franks should die. Some were yelling things like, "Kill the Jew." I was very nervous. The courtroom was filled with people. Every seat was taken. I was interested mostly in getting out of there. I spoke with a speech impediment and had trouble pronouncing the R in Frank's name in those days. The lawyers put their heads together and said that it was obvious I knew nothing since I was so young and would let me off the stand. It was not an easy place for a young boy to be, there in a court like that. I never fully realized until I was older that if I had told what I knew, Leo Frank would have been acquitted and gone free. Instead, he was imprisoned. After he was convicted, my mother told me there was nothing we could do to change the jury's verdict. My father agreed with her. I continued to remain silent. Later, Leo Frank was lynched by a mob from Marietta, Georgia. I know, of course, that because I kept silent, Leo Frank lost his life. I have spent many nights thinking about that. I have learned to live with it. I now swear to the events I witnessed that fatal day, Confederate Memorial Day, 1913, when Mary Fagan, who was just about my age, 14, was killed. I came to work on time that morning at about 8 o'clock. I rode the streetcar from my home on South Gordon Street, and when I walked into the building, Jim Conley, the janitor, who was also called a sweeper, was sitting under the stairwell on the first floor of the building. Although it was early in the morning, Conley had obviously consumed considerable beer. He drank a lot, even in the mornings. He spoke to me. He asked me for a dime to buy beer. A dime could buy a good-sized beer in those days. I told Jim Conley I didn't have a dime. That was not the truth. I had some money in my pocket, but I had let Conley have a nickel or a dime for beer before. He never paid me back. I didn't like to be around Jim Conley. After I told Conley I didn't have any money, I went up the stairs to the second floor where my desk was located in the office of Leo Frank. My job required that I open the mail, file papers, keep the office orderly, run errands, and the like. Leo Frank arrived in the building that morning shortly after I did. He came into the office and spoke to me. I always called him Mr. Frank, and he referred to me by my given name, Alonzo. I do not know whether Leo Frank had seen Jim Conley on the first floor when he came into the building that morning. A substitute secretary worked for Leo Frank that morning. As I remember, it was a routine Saturday for me at the office. Because of Memorial Day, the factory part of the company was closed. But sometimes on Saturdays, people who had worked at the factory during the week would come to the pay window in the office and collect their salaries. Girls who worked in the factory made about 12 cents an hour. I did not know Mary Fagan by name, but I had seen her at the factory and knew her face. We were just about the same age. I was supposed to meet my mother that day, about noon, and go to the Confederate Memorial Day parade. When I left the premises just before noon, Mary Fagan had not come to the pencil factory. She apparently came to pick up her pay shortly after I left to go meet my mother. Sometime after 11:30, and perhaps as late as 11:45, I told Mr. Frank that my mother wanted me to meet her so that I could go to the parade with her. I didn't care all that much about seeing the parade, but my mother wanted me to go. Mr. Frank agreed for me to leave at that time. I told him I would return to the office and complete my filing work later in the afternoon. He said he expected he would still be there. When I left the company premises just before noon, Mary Fagan had not come to collect her pay. When I left the building, down the stairs and out the first floor front door, Jim Conley, the janitor, was sitting where I had seen him when I came to work, in the darkened area of the stairwell. I walked to the point where I was supposed to meet my mother. It was a short distance, perhaps a block and a half. We had agreed to meet in front of a store on Whitehall Street. My memory is that my mother had planned to buy a hat that day. I stopped and bought a hot dog on the way to meet her. However, when I arrived, she was not there. She had told me that if she was unable to come, for me not to worry. I waited for her for a few minutes. Since I didn't care that much about seeing the parade, I went back to work. I can't be sure as to exactly how long I was gone, but it could not have been more than half an hour before I got back to the pencil factory. I had no idea that I was about to witness an important moment in a famous murder case, a moment that has not been made public until now, that I was about to become a witness to tragic history. I walked into the building by the front door. Inside the door, I walked toward the stairwell. I looked to my right, and I was confronted by a scene I will remember vividly until the day I die. Jim Conley was standing between the trapdoor that led to the basement and the elevator shaft. I have an impression that the trapdoor was partially open, but my eyes were fixed on Jim Conley. He had the body of Mary Fagan in his arms. I didn't know it was Mary Fagan, I only knew it was a girl. At that moment, I couldn't tell if she was alive. She appeared to be unconscious, or perhaps dead. I saw no blood. He was holding her with both arms gripping her around the waist. I can't remember the color of her clothes, but I have an impression that she had on pretty, clean clothes. She was extremely short, and her head was sort of on his shoulder or over it. Her hair was streaming down his back. Her hair was not in braids when I saw her. It was hanging loose. I saw no blood on the part of her neck that was exposed. I do not know if she was dead, but she was at least unconscious. She was limp and did not move. Her skirt had come up to about her knees. It was as I suddenly barged into the first floor, prepared to go up the stairs to the office, that I encountered Conley with the body of Mary Fagan. Conley was close to the trapdoor that led down into the basement by way of a ladder. I believe that from the direction he was headed and the attitude of the body, that he was preparing to dump Mary Fagan down the trapdoor. I have no clear memory of whether the elevator had stopped on the first floor, but if it was not on that floor, the shaft would have been open. Conley could have dumped her down the elevator, empty elevator shaft. I believe for some reason Jim Conley turned around toward me. He either heard my footsteps coming or he sensed I was behind him. He wheeled on me, and in a voice that was low but threatening and frightening to me, he said, "If you ever mention this, I'll kill you." I turned and took a step or two, possibly three or four steps, up toward the second floor, but I must have worried about whether the office upstairs was closed. I did hear some movement upstairs, but I can't be sure who was on the floors above. I was fearful that the office might be closed, and so I turned back toward Conley. I wanted to get out of there quick. He got to within 8 feet of me. He reached out as if to put an arm or hand on me. I ran out the front door and raced away from that building. I went straight home. I rode the streetcar. Once at home, I told my mother what I had just seen. I told her what Jim Conley had said to me about killing me. I didn't know for sure that the girl in his arms was dead. My mother was very disturbed by what I told her. She told me that I was never, never to tell anybody else what I had seen that day at the factory. She said she didn't want me involved or the family involved in any way. She told me to go on about my business as if nothing had happened and that sometime soon I would have to quit working there. From then on, whenever I was at work, I steered clear of Jim Conley. I kept away from him, and he did the same. When my father came home, my mother explained to him what I had seen and what Conley had said to me. My father told me to forget it and never mention it. My mother was a very strong-willed woman who was 30 years younger than my father, and he said to me what she wanted him to say. Later on, he told me that Frank would never be convicted. I have wished many times that my mother hadn't taken that attitude, and that either she had told the authorities or that she had encouraged me to tell somebody, perhaps Leo Frank, what I had seen. When the detectives later questioned me, I told only the part of the story up to the time I left that day to go meet my mother. I did not tell that I had come back into the building and saw Conley with a body. When Frank went on trial and I was called as a witness, my mother told me I would have to go and testify. She told me to keep to myself what I had seen. She said if I were not asked a specific question, I did not have to give a specific answer. Jim Conley was the chief witness against Leo Frank. He testified that Frank had called him to his office a little after noon that day and told him that Mary Fagan's body was in the metal room on the second floor. He testified that Frank told him to get the body and take it on the elevator down to the basement. He swore that he tried to carry the body to the elevator but dropped Mary Fagan because she was too heavy for him to carry. According to Conley's testimony, Frank picked up her legs while Conley lifted up the upper part of her body. Conley said that Frank had pulled the rope to start the elevator down and that they went with the body directly to the basement, past the first floor, without stopping there. Conley claimed that Frank dragged the body from the elevator to a point in the rear of the building. Conley contended during the trial that after Frank dragged the body away from the elevator, Conley ascended in the elevator and Frank came back upstairs by way of the trapdoor to the first floor, and then came on the stairway from the first to the second floor. I know all that testimony was false. It was Conley who had the body on the first floor. He was alone with the body. Frank was not there on the first floor. Conley did not tell the truth when he said the body was taken from the second floor to the basement. He had the body on the first floor. I know from what I read of the case that Mary Fagan had come into the building shortly after I went out to meet my mother. She went upstairs to the second floor. Leo Frank had given her pay envelope. I understand that she had worked one day that week and she was entitled to about $120. I am convinced that she had left the pay window and was coming down the stairs or had reached the first floor when she met Conley, who had been looking for money when I came in that morning. I am confident that I came in just seconds after Conley had taken the girl's money and grabbed her. I do not think sex was his motive. I believe it was money. Her pay was never found in the building after she died. Many times I have thought since all this occurred almost 70 years ago that if I had hollered or yelled for help when I ran into Conley with the girl in his arms that day, I might have saved her life. I might have. On the other hand, I might have lost my own life. If I had told what I saw that day, I might have saved Leo Frank's life. I didn't realize it at the time. I was too young to understand. As the years have gone by, I've told this secret to a number of people. I told it when I was in the Army in World War I. In fact, I had a fight with another soldier who became angry when I said Leo Frank did not kill the girl, but that Conley did. I have told other people. I told my late wife. She urged me not to make it public because she felt it wouldn't do any good. She said it would not bring back Leo Frank and it would not bring back Mary Fagan. And I told other relatives and friends. On one occasion, I believe in the 1950s, when I was operating a restaurant, I discussed this with a reporter in Atlanta. But the reporter said that since Leo Frank's wife was still alive, it was not a matter the newspaper wanted to open up. Leo Frank was convicted by lies heaped on lies. It wasn't just Conley who lied. Others said that Leo Frank had women in the office for immoral purposes and that he had liquor there. There was a story that he took women down in the basement. That cellar was filthy. It was filled with coal dust. I was in the basement twice and remember the dirt and filth there. That was all false. Leo Frank was a good office manager. He was always proper with people who worked for him. There were witnesses who told lies, and I remained silent. So really, all the 10 or so people who are claiming that he was hitting on these girls were all making that up? Now I am finally making this public. I have found reporters, Jerry Thompson and Bob Sherborne, who have heard my story and who understand that it is a case that is important to history. I'm glad to have it all come out. At last, I am able to get this off my heart. I believe it will help people to understand that courts and juries make mistakes. They made a mistake in the Leo Frank case. I think it is good for all to come out, even at this late date. And then we have some pictures. We're about 260 pages in. The picture of the two Marys as children, both Mary Fagans. Somewhat similar. Mary Fagan and Alonzo Mann look through the author's scrapbook. It's an interesting picture. And then we see the grave of little Mary Fagan. With Watson's inscription on it, which we read at the start of this. Again, it's shots of Mary Fagan and mature Mary Fagan. All right, moving on to page 257. And this is still Alonzo Mann. There will be some people who will be angry at me because I kept all this silent until it was too late to save Leo Frank's life. They will say that being young is no excuse. They will blame my mother. The only thing I can say is that she did what she thought was best for me and the family. Other people may hate me for telling it. I hope not, but I am prepared for that, too. I know that I haven't a long time to live. All that I have said is the truth. When my time comes, I hope that God understands me better for having told it. This is what matters. On March 19, 1982, my father and I went to Woodruff Library at Emory University to research the case again and learn more about the role of Alonzo Mann. This was the first time my father and I had gone together to research the case. When we signed in, the librarian observed us curiously as we checked out more information. She asked my father, "What did you think of little Mary Fagan?" My father replied, "Young lady, I wasn't even a gleam in my father's eye in those years." We both laughed and the librarian relaxed. When we told the librarian what we were looking for, she directed us to a copy of the Tennessean, since one of the Tennessean's reporters had been instrumental in breaking the story of Alonzo Mann's confession. From our research, we learned that Alonzo Mann was indeed Leo Frank's office boy. Mann had begun working April 1st, 1913, so, you know, the murder happened 26 days later, or 25 days later on the 26th, and had worked two Saturdays before the murder occurred. And he testified that he had left the factory at, quote, half past 11. Before we left that day, the librarian gave us the name and address of the Tennessean librarian. On March 23, 1982, I wrote a letter to Sandra Roberts, the Tennessean librarian. "Your name was given to me by the librarian at the Woodruff Library at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. My father and I were researching the Mary Fagan-Leo Frank case. She showed us a copy of the Tennessean. We would like two copies if possible. My father and I are very interested in this case because we are direct descendants of little Mary Fagan. My grandfather, William Joshua Fagan, was Mary's brother. My father is a nephew, and I am a great-niece. We would pay for the cost of the newspaper." On March 26th, Sandra Roberts called. She told me that the newspaper staff would be in Atlanta on March 31st. She asked if they might drop by and hand-deliver the newspapers. Before this time, my father was always the one who dealt with anyone inquiring about the Fagans. He had always represented our family's opinion. I called my father to let him know about the meeting and to see if he could be there to meet the staff, too. I had never spoken of my feelings about the murder, and I could sense his concern. He didn't think he'd be able to be there, but he wanted to make sure that either a friend, my husband, or another family member would be. And that's the end of chapter 10. Let's just proceed right ahead into chapter 11. The Fagans break their vow of silence. Nervousness, curiosity, and excitement all plagued me as I waited the arrival of the Tennessean staff. My mind flitted back and forth to questions I wanted to ask. I wondered what their response would be to me and whether they would push me to come forward with the statement that Mary Fagan's convicted murderer was innocent. Why, I thought, was that young girl's murder never forgotten? My family and I never really fathomed the publicity that continued almost unabated since her untimely death. And the media never once considered what the publicity did to the Fagan family. But Mary Fagan's legacy is a real part of all of our lives, especially mine. It also occurred to me that my father was right in his assessment of the media's handling of the story. He had told me the story of little Mary Fagan would never be forgotten, and that every 3 to 5 years the story would reappear in some form in the media. He had also thought the story would never be put to rest because the Jewish community would not be satisfied until Leo Frank's innocence could be established. And with the Alonzo Mann story, that now seemed possible. The Tennessean had sent two staff reporters and a photojournalist to the house. I introduced myself as Mary Fagan, and my confidence returned. We discussed the Mary Fagan-Leo Frank case. They asked no probing questions. One of my questions was about how the Alonzo Mann evidence had come to the light. One of the reporters, Jerry Thompson, explained that he had been working undercover in the KKK for over a year, developing a story depicting the current KKK. When they discovered that he was a reporter, there were several threats made against his life. The newspaper hired guards to protect him in his house. One of these guards was a Bob Mann, who is Alonzo Mann's nephew. Bob told Jerry that his uncle had witnessed a murder in Atlanta in 1913, but knew no other details. Jerry was intrigued. He spoke with his publisher, who agreed to run a series of stories on the convictions of innocent people. At that time, the series was considered to be low profile. Jerry had never heard of Mary Fagan or Leo Frank. That began to change when, in working on the series, he called Alonzo Mann. A few weeks later, Jerry met a rabbi who happened to mention Leo Frank, and it clicked. Armed with what Alonzo Mann had told him, Jerry then met again with his publisher. The story was given top priority. Why did Alonzo Mann wait until 1982? The staff told me that Mann's mother didn't want their name involved in the case and feared for their safety. Alonzo Mann liked Leo Frank and had been relieved that Frank's sentence was commuted. Mann had hoped that the truth would be found out during the appeals process. Leo Frank's lynching made that superfluous. The newspaper staff asked me to comment on Mann's testimony. They said they'd be happy to send over any other materials I might need. As they were leaving, they invited me to a press conference to be held at the Atlanta Jewish Community Center on April 1st. I accepted, but asked to remain anonymous. The Atlanta Jewish Community Center is on Peachtree Street, one of the most well-known streets in Atlanta. It is a low brick building that resembles those sprawling public schools I attended when we moved back to the States. But it was months after the night before I saw it that distinctly. My surroundings were a blur the night I attended the press conference for the first time I was participating, even though as an anonymous observer, in a public discussion of my great-aunt's murder. Bernard and I had decided that the best way to retain anonymity was to register as Mr. and Mrs. Keene. Because of my family's silence, I was not emotionally prepared to come forward at a news conference. In fact, the Tennessean staff had agreed that anonymity would probably be best since I had doubts about making any sort of statement, and I had no idea what they were going to present to the Jewish community. The room was a typical conference area. Seated around the table were reporters who were either asked to be present or who had an interest in the case. As we entered the room, the Tennessean staff asked me to sit near them. Reporters directed questions concerning all areas of the case to the Tennessean staff for approximately 30 to 45 minutes. Of foremost interest, of course, was Alonzo Mann's affidavit and whether a posthumous pardon would be sought for Leo Frank. At the conference, I listened intently and watched the facial expressions of those present. What were these people thinking, I wondered, and how did they come to their conclusions? After all questions were discussed, we were ushered into a huge main room, which was filled to capacity. My husband and I sat in the back row. I felt most comfortable there. The Tennessean staff reporters, Jerry Thompson and Robert Sherborne, publicly presented to the Jewish community the review of evidence for Leo Frank's innocence. Then they answered questions. Most of the questions concerned the effect of Alonzo Mann's affidavit as the missing link of evidence to finally substantiate Leo Frank's innocence. One question involved the Fagan family. An individual wanted to know the reaction of my family. Jerry Thompson stated that some Fagan family members upheld their belief in the convicted Leo Frank's guilt, while others, quote, were trying to be objective. I knew he was talking about me. I had my own opinion, but I wanted to hear what they had to say. I was trying to be objective, but because of my emotional involvement, it was painful for me, or it was difficult for me. The meeting adjourned on the thought that the posthumous pardon for Leo Frank was likely to be an issue for the governor's race. By the time we got to the car, tears were running down my face, and I didn't quite know why. In thinking over the conference the following day, I realized that while listening to Jerry Thompson and Robert Sherborne present their evidence to the Jewish community, I had thought how strange it was that they had asked me to be objective, since they themselves had decided that Alonzo Mann's conclusions were true and could not themselves be all that objective. At the time, all I could see was my grandfather and my father telling me the story of little Mary Fagan over and over again. They had always told me that Leo Frank was convicted of her murder. How could I not believe them and the evidence? They had never withheld the truth from me. Truth was valuable to them and to me. How could I reconcile the two views? On April 4th, just 3 days after the news conference, my youngest brother, Michael, died. I was the oldest and he was the youngest. We were very close. He looked up to me, and I depended on him more than he ever knew. Michael had a lot of difficult times in his life, but he always knew that the family supported him. We didn't always agree with what he did, but we never stopped loving him. His death devastated me. I couldn't believe he wouldn't be around anymore. I couldn't believe we'd never talk again. Michael was buried next to our grandfather. I placed flowers on each grave. For the first time, I began to understand the depth of my grandfather's grief over his sister's death and why he couldn't talk about it. I wish that I could tell him so. Placing the red rose in his grave was my gesture to him that I finally understood. Some griefs can never be overcome. Like my father, I learned there are two things in life you can't share: grief and pain. On April 6th, the following article appeared in the East Cobb Neighbor, a neighborhood newspaper near Marietta. Jewish leaders seek exoneration for Frank. Leaders of the Atlanta Jewish community say they are seeking ways to obtain a posthumous exoneration of Leo Frank, the turn-of-the-century Atlanta businessman convicted of and lynched for the murder of a Marietta girl, a murder a witness in the case now says Frank did not commit. And one of three Nashville, Tennessee newspaper reporters who broke the apparent new development in the 69-year-old case says he is ready to help clear Frank's name, not only historically, but legally, close quote. The statements came last week before two of the reporters, Jerry Thompson and Robert Sherborne of the Tennessean, told an audience at the Atlanta Jewish Community Center about their discovery of a possible turnaround in the Frank case. In a package of copyright stories published last month, the Tennessean revealed that the 82-year-old Alonzo Mann of Bristol, Virginia, says an employee of Frank actually killed 14-year-old Mary Fagan. Of course, he did not see her killed. He said she was at least unconscious, but she may have been dead. So it doesn't change anything. The April 1913 murder of the girl at the National Pencil Company in Atlanta, where she, Mann, Frank, and Jim Conley, the man Mann says was the killer, worked, began one of the most sensational legal episodes of the century. Frank, a Jew, was convicted on what even then was considered fuzzy evidence at a time of intense anti-Jewish feeling in the city, like the city was anti-Jewish before it heard about this murder. I mean, the anti-Jewish feeling, as you know, they reverse the cause and effect, was caused by the Jew doing this to this white girl. His death sentence was later commuted by Georgia's governor, but a mob pulled Frank from prison in 1914 and hanged him from a tree on Roswell Street. Actually, it was 1915. From a tree on Roswell Street in Marietta, just east of what is now Cobb Parkway. Gerald Cohen, vice president of the Atlanta Jewish Federation, said last week the new twist in the Frank case, quote, has really set the Atlanta community back on its heels, close quote. Sherry Frank, no relation to Leo Frank, area director of the American Jewish Committee, said Jewish leaders would like to make a possible exoneration of Frank an issue in the gubernatorial race this year. That time after Michael's death was the most difficult period of my life so far. Nothing mattered. For the first time, I could not get excited over, nor even care about, the burgeoning resurgence of interest in Mary Fagan's death. Then I received a letter from Sandra Roberts. Dear Mary and Bernard, I am sending you the latest stories that we have had on the Frank case. I am also enclosing copies of the letters on which the story was based. The original letters are in the Goldfarb Library of Brandeis University. That's a Jew university in Waltham, Massachusetts. There are non-Jews there, but it's heavily Jewish. Brandeis. Brandeis. Siegenthaler, president, editor, and publisher, told me this morning that the reaction to the Frank story continues to pour in from all over the world. Reporters and television people are trying their best to get Lonnie Alonzo Mann to tell his story again, but he seems more comfortable just dealing with Bob and Jerry. I believe that he is at peace with himself at last. I must admit, Mary, that when I first received your letter, I was purely curious about your reaction to the section. However, since our visit, I've tried to put myself in your place. I've wondered what I would do if I were Mary Fagan. From the beginning, this story has been fascinating, but it was merely another story to me. It is easy for me to remain objective as a researcher, since I have no personal involvement with the people, the races, the religions, or even the state concerned. It was simple for me to sit silently in the Jewish Community Center in Atlanta and view the product of two conflicting cultures. On one hand, I witnessed a mass of people totally convinced that one of their brothers was brutally and unjustly lynched. Moreover, they have remained angry for 70 years because they believe he was lynched because he was Jewish. On the other hand, I saw one small woman who bears not only the name, but also the face and figure of an aunt that she will never know. I felt your total devotion to a family and a legacy that will always bear the burden of the senseless slaughter of a beautiful young girl. I honestly don't know what I would do if I were you, Mary. But your options seem clear. You could remain silent and let the past stay buried, or you could make a statement indicating your reaction to the resurgence of the Fagan Frank case. When I spoke with Siegenthaler this morning, he revealed his concern and curiosity about your reaction to the case. He assured me of a few things. If you should decide to make a public statement concerning the case, there will be immediate worldwide response to it. The Tennessean would print any statement that you or your father would make. You could indicate your belief of Frank's guilt or innocence, or you could simply react to the new evidence of Alonzo Mann's testimony. Any statement that you could make could be preceded by a visit with Mr. Mann. I think that might be really interesting. We would also let you read this story in full before its publications. I was quite surprised when John made the last suggestion. It flies in the face of a basic rule of journalism. That's true. It's basically a bad idea to let sources try see stuff before it goes out. It might help avoid errors, and that's why you sometimes do it, but it generally can lead to them trying to control it, what you say, if they don't like any negative thing you might say. No matter what your decision is, I have another personal promise to you. I assure you that you have a newfound friend in Nashville who has tried very hard to feel the story through your heart. There are many times in this business that sensitivity and objectivity clash. Reporters must remind themselves that what is merely a story for the newspaper could be a thunderbolt in the existence of a human being. Maybe that is why I prefer the research end of journalism. Best wishes, Sandra. I read her letter again and again and realized that she was indeed a friend. Her letter stayed with me. Sandra felt compassion for me, and I knew she would not ask anything from me that made me uncomfortable or somehow uneasy. It made me feel good that she respected me as an individual. She knew that I was struggling inside. Sandra's letter also made me see something else in myself. I was fighting my legacy at the Atlanta Jewish Community Center. I couldn't see it before reading and rereading her letter, but that was why I cried so abruptly and bitterly after the news conference. Now those feelings were over, gone. I could never deny or fight my legacy again. I would now be able to stand up and acknowledge that I am Mary Fagan. My family's strength during my brother's death also proved to me that I could never forget who I was or where I came from. I was proud of my heritage. On April 18, I wrote Sandra to tell her of my brother's death. I also reiterated that I would not make a public statement concerning Alonzo Mann's affidavit at that time. I still felt that the past should stay buried. Sandra responded on April 22nd with yet another warm and sympathetic letter. Dear Mary and Bernard, here is the long-promised tape of the WRFG program. The producer, Chris Kuhn, did most of the research. The narrator, Sherry Condor, is a librarian at Georgia State Library and Archives. She did her master's thesis on Governor Slayton, and she knows a lot about the case. You'd really enjoy her if you get to meet her. Mary, I'm really sorry about Michael. I don't know the circumstances, if it was accidental or an illness, but I'm sure you are a great comfort to your parents. Don't worry about this statement. I'll be honest with you. Your statement would make a really great story for this newspaper. Bob and Jerry and Siegenthaler would really like to have it. But, as I reminded them, what is one great story for us could alter your life considerably. I'm sure that the chances are good that other news people may track you down if they haven't already. So all I'm asking is, if and when you decide to say something, please let the Tennessean have a little warning. I hope your healing is swift and as painless as possible. Let me know when you need anything that I can help you with. Best wishes, Sandra. While reading through the newspaper articles I collected, I came across the name Mike Wing, a member of the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles. Another big first step. Why not call him, introduce myself, and let him know about my family? When I told him that my name was Mary Fagan and of my relationship to little Mary Fagan, he reacted with utter shock. Mike Wing, like countless others, never knew that there were surviving Fagan family members. I wanted the board to know, I told him, that there were indeed surviving close family members of Mary Fagan, and that the family was anxious to be notified of any information brought before the media. I asked to be informed if an application for a posthumous pardon for Leo Frank was received. At the very least, this would ensure that if the story broke, I'd know ahead of time. So see, the Jews are in there fighting, and if there's no one else competing with them, then they have an even easier road of it than they do with complete media control. He was responsive. During the conversation, he was curious about the fact that the Fagan family had never publicly acknowledged themselves. I explained that the murder had been a deeply traumatic event whose reverberations we still felt, and that we had never seen the need to say anything. It had been, we hoped, best to keep a vow of silence among ourselves. But that's not the best way where a Jew has infringed on you. He said he felt certain an application would be filed. He took my address and phone number and those of my father. After that, I wasn't scared anymore. I was glad that I had called Mike Wing, and I felt confident that if he did indeed receive a posthumous pardon application for Frank, he would inform me. But my brother's death continued to cloud my life. I began to ask myself some difficult questions, including why he died and what the true value and purpose of my life was. I and other close family members learned once again the importance and significance of family and how vital it was that we continue being loving and caring to one another always. Then in August, a happy event. I was the matron of honor in Amy's wedding. Amy and I had remained close friends after I left Florida. Like most good friends, we had our good and fun times, and also had some conflicts. It didn't matter, though. We always resolved them. This is her Jew friend. Amy was there for me when Michael died, too. She kept in close contact since she knew me well and knew I was having a difficult time adjusting. The wedding was a beautiful Jewish ceremony, and I learned many new things. Her family became my family, and I became a part of her family. The love and happiness we all shared was a healing force for me. And that will end chapter 11, so we'll leave it there. And I think next time we will do one grand summation and just finish the whole thing. There's still probably about 45 pages left. So yeah, that'll be a good long, a nice hour and a half probably. Anyway, chapter 12 will be application for pardon. So they're trying to bring the whole thing full circle and find this Jew innocent, even though he's guilty. Now, we have completed chapters 9, 10, and 11 in this particular session. We will have one more. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.